And Juneteenth Radio will be back next week, same time, same channel, 8 a.m. every Thursday morning. Thank you, callers, and big time thank you, listeners, and thank you for paying for our station to be on
there. I think he would be pleased with the progress that people are making. And basically, people, we are a government that is for the people, by the people. That is the real, I think, exciting thing that will be in his mind. I'm very optimistic about people. It's unfortunate that sometimes we have to have tragedies such as the recent one with the Flight 007 to acknowledge very openly our desire to come and join together. But we do have those, and it's unfortunate, but we do have those. And
you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web, and the time is 8:59 a.m.
This legislation passing to write. We're going to encourage them to write, but we're going to have available to them a special number they will call. It will be a lettergram or a telegram that they can send.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Now stay tuned for Fortress on a Hill.
Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You good
people. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Henry, one of the co-hosts of our show. The episode you're about to hear is an evergreen episode of ours from the fall of 2020, where we and our guests, Pam Campos Palma, are discussing the murder of Vanessa Guillen at Fort Hood, Texas, and the subsequent investigation into her death. Since that time, there has been a significant amount of news about the Army's response to her death, most prominently noted in the Fort Hood report that was recently released, and discussed in detail how the responses to her disappearance and murder were handled by various aspects of the Army's leadership and law enforcement. I will link the report here if you'd like to read it, but it's important to understand that our discussion today will not cover these newest aspects to Vanessa's story. Good morning, listeners. Welcome to a new episode of Fortress on a Hill. We're here today with Pam Campos Palma. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Who is going to discuss with us the case, the investigation, the reality of the murder of Vanessa Guillen? It's a hard subject, but we need to try to find some truth. And good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
One of my pet peeves is saying people's names wrong.
Yeah. No worries.
Okay, so to start off, I want to give some details about the case, just so everybody can have a little bit of familiarity if they haven't been reading about it. In late April this year, Vanessa Guillen's unit declared her missing, and they said that she was supposed to have gone from her arms room, where she worked as an Army armorer, somebody who works on weapons, on machine guns and stuff, to a different arms room for a different company, but in the same
overall unit. I mean, not the company, but the battalion brigade, you know, in the big unit sense. And then no one saw her again after that. She was supposed to show up at the motor pool to provide some serial numbers for the stuff that she was working on, and she just did not show up. The biggest thing I'd like to point out from that time is that she left personal items of hers, to include her wallet and her barracks room key, in the arms room. It's essentially leaving the key to her house, just leaving it behind. And it's curious why they didn't attempt to do something about that at the time. There also was no interview conducted immediately with whom we believe to be the killer, a specialist Robinson. But he should have been interviewed then as the person who last saw Vanessa. You know, even if she happened to disappear in a way that wasn't connected to Robinson, his statement, an interview of him would have been very valuable. And it didn't happen right away. I think it happened 6 or 7 days later. We then move over to mid-May. There was huge delays in trying to find out information. That's been a big ongoing issue with Vanessa's family, trying to question CID, the FBI, Vanessa's chain of command about what's happening, and receiving very little, if any, useful information. In mid-May, it came out that there were two witnesses to seeing Specialist Robinson carry a tough box from where he worked in his arms room out to his personal vehicle. They said that the box was very heavy, but it didn't. That information didn't come out until mid-May, and something I plan to poke at a little bit later. But you know, just for everybody going in, we then move a little bit further towards the end of May, beginning of June, where cell phone records requested by CID and the FBI pinged Robinson and his girlfriend at a place outside Fort Hood, near the Leon River in Texas, and ultimately that was where her remains were found. And then lastly, once it was cleared, once her remains were actually discovered, once they actually knew what they were dealing with, Specialist Robinson got confined to his barracks. He then ran away from the barracks, snuck past whatever people were guarding him. And then when confronted by local law enforcement out in Killeen, outside of Fort Hood, he killed himself. There's a lot of other information about the case. So listeners, if you're looking for more of the standard kind of stuff, that's not really what we're going to be discussing today. The mainstream media coverage of this has been very, very stereotypical. You know, not asking many questions, not pointing out crucial things that needed to be noted about what happened to Vanessa and how the investigation has moved forward. Pam, I'd like to give you first dibs at this. Can you tell the listeners your impressions of what happened to Vanessa and the larger systemic issues that are involved in that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll start off by saying that I think the realm of this issue, military, you know, the systemic issues of military sexual violence, corruption with impunity. I mean, these are repeatedly for me as an organizer in this field, this is one of the hardest realms to work in, because one, it's so pervasive, but there's such a dichotomy between, you know, many of us who served, this is not a surprise. Another, you know, case is just one in the pan of so many over so many decades. But there's a clear rift where, you know, with this case, there was a few things that were different, I think. Vanessa Guillen's family, of Mexican descent, an immigrant family, was very loud. From the second that she was disappeared, and was very clear. Vanessa Guillen's mother, Gloria Guillen, has been clear, and the most clear throughout months, around the fact that her daughter told her that she was being sexually harassed by a superior. And one thing that caught my eye very early on was that this was really lost, because Gloria Guillen was only doing Spanish media interviews because she only speaks Spanish. It has become now common knowledge that, like so many of us, Vanessa Guillen enlisted in the army to be able to grant her family citizenship. And so it's the same story. You just kind of see the same story for many of us, where the military is an outlet for upward mobility. There's corruption and impunity. And she's, you know, the hashtag I am Vanessa Guillen took off because I think we are in a reckoning moment in this country, tired of the hypocrisies, tired of the injustices, and thousands on thousands of survivors from military sexual crimes rang out and said no more, right? In a way that was also different. Another thing that Gloria Guillen did that was different is she did not treat DOD generals, commanders with the blind allegiance and respectability politics that we usually see. In fact, she has said the opposite. And increasingly, she has been very candid and open about the oppressive engagements, the racism. Most recently in DC, she said CID is lying and they are the criminals. And so I think that there have been decades of missing and murdered, definitely women, but I think as we've seen with the cases coming out of Fort Hood, this has been pervasive. And, you know, a good reminder, and the thing that I find so astonishing, is that Fort Hood is among the largest and most resourced Army installations in the United States. So one would think, and the biggest question that came up from the very beginning is, how does a soldier go missing off of one of the most secure places, supposedly, on the face of the earth, right? And to that end, there are now 23 by the Fort Hood's, you know, and this is where I think this conversation is so important, by Fort Hood officials' own account, there have been 23 dead soldiers in and around Fort Hood this year alone. Right. I frankly, many of us have lost count of the accounts of deaths, and several of them are classified as suicides or accidents. But the big question remains, if the Department of Defense continues to investigate itself, if Congress doesn't ask any real questions and is very comfortable with that system, how are we to know that they are not concealing criminality by their own hand? And, you know, many of us believe that the typical mechanisms and tropes of scapegoating junior enlisted, scapegoating, you know, just, you know, soldiers that don't know any better. This is just an occupational hazard. These are all mechanisms to avoid actual accountability and consequence from the people at the top who have allowed this to be commonplace within our armed services. And the last thing I'll say is that the attention on Vanessa Guillen has been really critical, not only on systemic changes, right? The fact of the matter is systemic racism and sexual violence is par for the course in military culture. It is a training tool from the second you step on basic training footsteps all the way to through the VA and even to people's untimely or timely death. And so this is a bigger problem that we must tackle. And the thing that is most glaring is, why is it that those people that should be accountable to the troops, the hypocrisy of we support the troops so much, have done little to nothing for decades, right? Zero tolerance has actually not meant zero tolerance. It has meant cover-ups and impunity.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 92.7. and online at kboo.fm. Our guest today is Pam Campos Palma, and we're discussing the murder of Vanessa Guillen.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I hate to get this wrong, but they found another soldier's body during the search, another missing soldier, I believe. Like, not related at all to the case, is what I believe I read, because there's so many folks missing that we don't have accountability. And you make a really important point about this. There's like a mythology about the military, as I see it, Some of it's film, some of it's politics, some of it's pretty nefarious. You know, the military is the most organized institution if you want, you know, and competent at everything. If you want a problem solved, give it to the military, no matter what it is, right? You know, mm-hmm. if we needed to fix kindergarten teaching around America, there's a significant portion of this country that would say, send in the military, they'll do it. But yet in reality, Fort Hood, this, I believe, the second largest military installation in the Americas, is missing all these soldiers and the culture that you're mentioning of race and patriarchy and just sexual violence. And it's in reality, what you have is an off the rails institution that is given sort of adulation that's beyond what it deserves. And I would ask you, this case has brought up, as you mentioned, issues that have existed for so long and gotten them into the public eye again, and maybe even more than previously. What do you think the context, right? Time, like temporal, and also just her individual case. What is it that is bringing this to the fore now, finally, more? Not perfectly, not enough, but, you know, what's the kind of perfect storm that we're seeing, if you could put your finger on it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're in a crisis. I know we all have seen for a while that this country is in a crisis of legitimacy and identity. And especially in this year of a hurricane of crises, right? Like, we have a front row seat, right? To the deep corruption, the hypocrisies, the contradictions, right, of living in a pandemic, but the government can't do, you know, or refuses to do little about it. The political willful ignorance around some of the most dastardly, systemic issues in our society, whether that's state violence, you know, whether that's the killing of Black men in the streets by, you know, and rampant state violence, or the fact that even if you serve in uniform as a brown person in America, it will not protect you. You are not protected. And so one thing that I think is really key that I've seen in my organizing throughout with this case in particular is the enormous hypocrisy of what does service actually mean in America, right? Because if you can't even keep troops safe, which there's this whole conversation around, like, you know, are troops more special and more sacred than any other living person, you know, in our country. But if you can't even do that, with the tropes and the hypocrisies of we love the troops, we're going to throw them in these endless wars, not serve them, and then keep them on these criminal, decrepit bases with no accountability, I think that we have reached a fever pitch in this country. And I think that it is not an accident that the particularly Latino, Latinx community has been out in droves. And the sentiments that I have heard most is, we want to serve this country, but it will not let us, whether that's in the military, whether that's as immigrants. And so there's something deeper with the Guillen case around this really terrible rupture moment. I also think that we're in a moment where we are seeing a breakdown in politicians. I mean, it's Congress's job to have oversight of the military. And they, even with the glaring gaps in the Guillen case, there's been lots of them who say, well, we're waiting on the Army to self-investigate. Literally, when the Army is not giving them, when anybody off the street can tell you that there's a cover-up, obviously, you know, in the mix here. And then I think lastly is, and I'm losing my train of thought a little bit. Sorry, it's been a heavy few months of this case and this organizing. But I would say that lastly, I've never seen survivors take their power back like this before. And one thing that has been different has been, you know, predominantly women have been ripping their wounds open and telling their, you know, we carry trauma in suitcases and then whip them out for people to around the exploitation, you know, killings and death and abuse of soldiers and troops and everyday working people. And finally, I think we're at a moment where lots of people said, no more. I'm not going to relitigate with you if rape culture is military culture. It is. And your precious institution, right? Like, there is a divide, I think, between those in the community, the military community, who frankly, profit. And, you know, the valor parts of it is profitable and really is a great meal ticket. And there's a tension, I think, in the community around how dare you criticize the military. And then survivors, people of color, women, the Guillen family for sure, saying, actually, it is the greatest betrayal to just have rose-colored glasses and not call the question on the corruption of an institution that we know is the most trusted institution in American society. This is irresponsible, and we must, you know, end and radically transform. So there's probably other things I'm missing, but that comes to mind.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Oni, just to jump in on that. Some of the things that you said really just resonated this question that we could probably do a whole pod on, and, you know, we won't go too far on, of like whether soldier lives matter more, you know, and I think that that's problematic, right? Same thing with like police lives, you know, there's this idea that because there's bagpipes at the ceremony and the sound of taps is haunting, that somehow, you know, when a uniform member of society, any paramilitary, that they're somehow more valuable. But even if we leave aside the problematic nature of, you know, emphasizing one life's value over another, there's, I think you point out the hypocrisy here of we all adulate the soldiers and the politicians and the media and the people who profit off of it emphasize like how much, I mean, almost with a degree of almost insecurity, it's like they're making this a salve to like make themselves feel better somehow, like they have to constantly laud the soldiers until it's hard, right? Or until mm-hmm. it's inconvenient, until it goes against the political narrative. And so, yeah, we love soldiers, but endless war is fine. Mm-hmm. We love soldiers, but rampant sexual abuse and assault across our military, including at our sacred cow military academies, and then we lie about it, and then there's no accountability for the stat fudging that went on there, you know, even when I was mm-hmm. teaching there. And so I think, you know, we adulate, it seems, and I think this is one of the things I'm hearing from you that's most interesting, is like we adulate the myth of the military rather than its reality. So the surface idea that it's just heroic and it's just a big, you know, walking American flag and everyone's equal and there's no color in the military, because everyone knows that, you know, the military is the most unifying institution and it's perfect. We adulate the myth, and then when like the dirty side and the real side and the underbelly is emphasized, it's funny how people polarize, and a lot of the most patriotic pro-troops folks will sort of attack the character of people and, you know, victim blame and just, you know, say, oh, how dare you make this a political football? But that's just me pontificating. But I think that's, you know, the things you're saying were just, they're so important and they're not said enough.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 92.7 and online at kboo.fm. Our guest today is Pam Campos Palma, and we're discussing the murder of Vanessa Guillen.
I mean, the other thing I would add is, I mean, this is a little bit also nerdy, but I think a lot about who's allowed to be fully, who's fully included, right? Vanessa Guillen's mother, the words keep ringing in my ears because it's the same thing my mother has said. You know, my mother is the one who encouraged me to enlist because she wanted me to have college money and upward mobility. And Vanessa Guillen's mother, Gloria, said, I gave this country the most precious thing. I gave, you know, my daughter. And I think that, I think a lot about how women, you know, people of color, queer and trans people, you know, children of immigrants, first generation people in the military. I myself have experienced that it's actually never enough. You will always be questioned and undermined. Where are you true, you know, loyalties? Who are you actually allegiant to? Are you actually one of us? And it is this dynamic of American identity. Really importantly, I have found it fascinating, but not surprising, how the Guillen case, whether it's a congressional hearing or in the news, the narrative is, you know, this black soldier is at fault. It's just junior enlisted people who don't know any better. It's just junior enlisted people that, you know, can't get it together. And they're, and there's a deep classism and racism and xenophobia that will always and consistently rely on the other as the scapegoat for the military's problems. Because by from the inception, we were never supposed to be part of the institution. We're just tools, right, in the machine. And so it's been really interesting, and I'm really actually curious to hear what you have to say, you know, because what I find so, I mean, so fascinating is that the rot is at the top, right? This is all distraction by design to make us forget that, like, there have been, like, there have been people that have served for decades in high-ranking power positions that there's no way you don't know that this is, you know, not a problem. Like, there's no, I think one of the colonels was asked in a hearing, like, have you looked at any of the Vanessa Guillen stories, you know, the survivor stories online? And his answer was, I'm not on social media. And so it's fascinating to me the deference that high-level commanders and generals are given when they, you would think, have supposedly the most authority and power to actually change the system.
Well, yeah, just yeah, one last thing, just to respond to what you're asking, or because you're provoking a lot of thoughts that are super important. The military, like often other paramilitary organizations such as the police, are like the biggest crybabies ever. You know, they say we're snowflakes, but if you question their like heroism, competence, or even just mythology, it's like they get really defensive. It's fascinating. But, you know, the generals do this where, and all officers and commanders, they take so much pride that they are judge, jury, defense, prosecutor, you know, in the administrative and even to some extent legal system within the military, this commander-driven thing. They take so much pride in that and how much power they have. They brag to each other. Like, the great thing about the military is I can handle problems myself, you know? Mm. We say that. I was a commander. I mean, I know these people. And yet, even a general officer, watch how quick when it's ugly, they like wash their hands of it and say like, well, I don't know. I don't control that. You know, it's not, it's just like they have it both ways. But what you mentioned about whether you truly belong and like the way the culture operates, unspoken, but also sometimes spoken, this idea of who's truly an American soldier. And I did find, and I don't love every aspect of how I felt over the course of 20 years involved with the military in one way or the other, but I do know now, and I think I knew then, that there was a sense that the truest of true soldiers, the real soldier, is a white male infantryman, scout, tanker, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that was there. And so I'll just give you an example of what I mean. My own, and I mean, this is like confession time, not cool, don't like it, hate myself for this. I didn't speak up enough when I was a cadet about just the terrible pejoratives that were thrown around and the subculture among the male cadets of the female cadets are like problematic, and there was like all these slangs that were thrown around about them. Oh, they're not attractive enough, or they're not as like, oh, they have such easy standards, you know. And I was never like a loud guy about that kind of stuff, but I kind of like let it happen, you know, just awful, just that kind of enabling. And I think that like to some degree below the surface, because I had said to myself like, well, I'm gonna go do like combat arms stuff and, you know, go, you know, martyr myself for nothing. You know, I'm not going to worry about like interaction with like the female cadets. I was always polite. I was always nice. I was never like a mean guy, but I just didn't like make an effort really to like understand or make a whole lot of friends among the female cadets. And then I go out into the Army where I don't really serve with females because, you know, just the type of units I was in at the time, especially. But I'll tell you what was a big change for me. I came back to teach at the Academy in 2014, and I was like, it was like I was blown away, you know, because like I really, for the first time, like truly connected with my female cadets, like talked to them offline and tried to understand and realizing what was going on, and like this enormous value that is brought to the military by all these different ways of thinking and types and diversities. And like, I don't know, because I've been out in the wars and seen us fail with the old method, and that's not the good reason, that's not the main reason, there's an ethics to it, but even just from like a practical reason, like seeing like the white male old militarism just smash against complex societies and fail, I was like, oh my God, I got this all wrong. And then of course, watching the sexual assault cases in some instances, several instances, my own students, and following it and watching the fails, it really changed how I view it. And the reason I even tell this story is probably partly like Catholic penance, but also this notion that if we're honest with ourselves, I think a lot of like officers, enlisted guys, combat arms, all kinds of people will say there is a subculture that you don't really belong unless you're this mythologized version of a soldier. And that's a long answer to your question or statement, but I think it's super important that we're self-aware about what's really going on, because if we don't say it and we don't admit it, then like, what's the point? We're never going to get forward at all.
Mm-hmm. And beyond, you know, my thought is beyond the consciousness, because this consciousness is contrary to the ethos, right? To what you said. In my experience, when it's raised, like one of the most politicizing experiences I had in the military was I found it very interesting how explicit racism and xenophobia, you know, I served in as an intel analyst, you know, sitting around all day watching the news, Fox News is on. And I had the experience often where working with, you know, security forces, the dehumanizing language of talking about people. And even in the times where like I was part of the whole hearts and minds, you know, pivot and whatever. And it was glaring to me how when we were talking about immigrants and, local nationals, et cetera, it was deeply jingoistic, racist, like ethno-nationalist almost language. And what was politicizing to me was, I remember very clearly, some conversation erupted in the office around diversity. And I think I said something pretty simple around like, I believe in equity and diversity and like, you know, women. And I was reprimanded for being too political. And so there is, I think, a warped sense of what is, you know, commonplace and like, what is the actual culture of the military, right? If you treat women as they are intruders, as they are liabilities, right? I hear countless stories from women who served that, you know, when they were in a hot situation on a deployment, men around them were just like, yeah, I'm not going to have your back because you can't have mine. Like, right? So like, this is deep. And I think it is so entangled in the institution's makeup that my question is consistently like, whose job is it to like, stop letting this incredible, like, forceful machine that has caused so much destruction. Where does the buck stop in terms of like, oh yeah, you know, soldiers going missing and dead at an exorbitant rate, rapes and murders. And, you know, and we're just talking, the other thing that I think about a lot is we're just talking about people in uniform, right? We're, like the Fort Hood deaths and missing soldiers, we're talking about soldiers. And we all know we all know, those of us that serve, that soldiers don't stay on base all the time. They go off base, they go on college campuses. You know, if you're on a deployed location, civilians are in the mix. So there's even a broader, you know, damage pool that I think about a lot. And to me, the constant question is Department of Defense defending what? And whose job is it to like course correct this mission? And is it even a redeemable institution? So I think that like this moment and the Guillen case in particular has kicked up a lot of questions, because the other thing I'll remind is that Gloria Guillen, the mother, her demands are clear. Shut down Fort Hood. She has said, we will not enlist our children if you don't get together and if you don't get justice from my daughter and if you don't fix the entire system. And she has, you know, understandably said, arrest these people. I think a lot about these commanders are still just hanging out on Fort Hood, like going to PT. I mean, I think a lot about back to, you know, adulation of troops, I don't understand in what rational mind you can love the troops and be completely complicit and complacent about the normalcy of our abuse and killings, whether in wars abroad or here on bases.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 92.7 and online at kboo.fm. Our guest today is Pam Campos Palma, and we're discussing the murder of Vanessa Guillen.
Henry, we've talked I've talked to the officers and the commander side a little bit, but in response to, you know, what Pam is saying, what jumps out at you both from the, you know, NCO position and the military police position, but also just like your values, like what's jumping at, like how, like, because I think we all see these things differently and maybe have different answers to this question.
My time in the Army, I served alongside with female MPs, and I consider them to be my sisters. You know, I didn't see them as weaker than me or less than me. They were right there doing the same things I was doing. For me, it was not even a question. But what I saw other men do, other NCOs, it was just abhorrent. That junior enlisted females would be harassed or thought of as far less than a male soldier at almost any turn. It didn't take a lot to have that happen. And also there, you know, that especially for the MP Corps, there is a on the small side, but a strong core of female NCOs and officers. And I remember a first sergeant, I just had a ceremony for Soldier of the Month. And apparently we were standing around, you know, getting a Friday safety brief or something else. And she screamed out at everybody, okay, who was the person that turned me into, crap, I'm blanking on the name. I was going to say Internal Affairs, but the Army doesn't have that. It might have been Equal Opportunity, but I can't remember exactly who the agency was. But anyways, so she screams that in front of all whatever 130, 140 of us, that someone had the gall to make a complaint somehow related to her. You know, that there was no way to see around it. I also saw women being harassed. My ex-wife, told me horrible stories about how she was treated by a specific NCO, and I, as her partner, I wanted to go beat the absolute of the guy, but that was not my fight to have. But it was very hard to see her in so much pain from that, and from wondering what the Army's social circles, how are they going to treat her now. She was working at the local MP station, and their little crews there, they're ones that run the radios and take 911 calls and stuff like that, they're very, very insular. No different than infantry squads or cap scouts or other things like that. But it was clear that there was two sets of rules, or maybe even more, that you know, the men could immediately say, you know, this woman is nothing, she's not a good soldier, she's a bitch or a slut, and immediately it changes the whole demeanor of how she's treated. You know, we live as units, we deploy as units, and those things aren't forgotten. And soldiers want to move up. They don't want to create problems. They don't want to create waves. But mainly is that they don't see this problem as them not standing up for fellow soldiers. They are able to detach themselves far enough from it that it's not their problem. And it very much is their problem. It's their problem to protect people that NCOs are tasked with two things, the accomplishment of the mission and welfare of the soldiers. And sometimes the mission, sometimes number one, is indeed number two.
taking care of soldiers is the mission. And this is a case like many others where that absolutely has not happened.
Yeah, you know, 100%. I think also I agree.
Inspector General, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Right, IG, yeah. Well, I mean, I 100% agree that if we're going to have a commanders-driven system, which I don't think we should, by the way, on certain cases, which we'll get to, but if we're going to have it, then you have to own it. And we've all seen, right, all three of us, I know, have seen how fast a unit can turn on a dime and accomplish a mission when it's important, or when they think it's important, or they think their boss thinks it's important, right? I mean, stamp out, cold, you know, just make it happen. Nobody sleeps, right? We do this for the most mundane things, like a PowerPoint briefing that gets scheduled the last second. And we've done it for big issues too, and I mean imperfectly, but I mean, just one example, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was getting ready to go away while I was in command. And, you know, the five of us would have lunch together like once a week, you know, and, you know, I was the communist and they were real Americans, and we would argue all the time, but we were buddies, right? We drank beers together. We got along just fine. And we would argue about, you know, gays in the military all the time. And that has obviously been completely imperfect, and it's not like a perfect transition, but they argued to me throughout that year, this is going to take the military down. If you know, it's the same arguments that were made about letting women in, about letting African-Americans in, like, it's going to destroy camaraderie, but this will be even worse because it's not just race or gender. It's like the, you know, sexuality. So somehow it's going to destroy morale. Actually, we're going to lose the war on terror, which has already been lost by doing this. Like, this was essentially how far the argument would go. And I would always say the same thing. I would say, I will bet you everything that I have that this is going to go off, not without a hitch in terms of it's, I'm sure, an incredibly difficult experience still, of course, to be, you know, gay, trans, anything in the military. So I'm not taking away from that. But in terms of the fact that it will happen, units will still accomplish their missions, I said, this is going to go off without a hitch. This is going to be, nothing's going to, like, it's going to be fine. And they were like, yeah, right. And of course, time and again, if you have to do something, or you think you do, or commanders make it a priority, it can happen. So we're not deploying hundreds of thousands of soldiers overseas anymore. Not that that would be an excuse. There is the ability to make this the priority. If the general officers wanted it to be, if the civilian officials of the Pentagon wanted it to be, and if individual captains, lieutenants, and sergeants wanted it to be, it could be. But of course, I think the caveat, and then I'll let us, like, you know, let Pam transition us, or you, Henry, but, like, the caveat is, of course, that, like, I do think that the commander-driven system for much of this is inherently flawed and has failed, right? And therefore, so I'm not lauding that system, which I think is worth talking about and I think needs to go in certain cases, and is archaic, by the way, and, like, undemocratic and a whole bunch of, like, problematic things. Like, but it's – and maybe unconstitutional, but it's – if we're going to have that system, then, like, we need to own it. And, like, it's on officers, non-commissioned officers, and certainly general officers to make it a priority. But they really don't, except saying the right thing and putting a blurb on a PowerPoint slide most of the time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 92.7 and online at kboo.fm. Our guest today is Pam Campos Palma, and we're discussing the murder of Vanessa Guillen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it comes back down to, I've been thinking a lot about military culture and how for us, like, sayings and different sayings, I think about them now. And the one that comes up for me is shut up and color. Shut up and color. It's one of the things I heard most in the military. And I think a lot about, I mean, to your point, what would be required is that whistleblowing and critical thinking not be punished in service. But as we all know, I mean, I'll speak for myself as, you know, someone who left as an NCO. I also went up for a commission twice. And I was told, you know, at the very end of my career, I went up for a commission. It was between myself and another colleague, a white man. And both of us were asked by this all-male board the question, when you become a commissioned officer of the Air Force, what would be your top systematic, you know, policy priority, which is a weird question. And he said, I would make sure that physical fitness standards would be more rigorously met. And I said, I would work to eradicate sexual harassment and assault in the Air Force. Mind you, we had just had a couple of pilots looking at porn in the tactics room. So that felt like a timely answer. And instead what happened was I was pulled aside. They asked a female intel colonel to pull me aside and ask me if I was okay and treat me with suspicion. And, you know, goes to say I did not get the commission. And so one of my biggest lessons learned from the military, and when I was enlisted active duty, I also filed an IG complaint. And I often joke that I started organizing in the military. But, you know, the military is exceptional hierarchy, the power dynamics. I keep having to remind people, like, this isn't a regular workplace. You don't have rights. And so even when I see, whether it's a lowly, you know, officer or NCO trying to protect their troops, or even like Captain Crozier, right, on the Roosevelt, trying to protect his people, there is, I believe, a mandate of punishment for anyone that dissents or speaks out or does try to do the right thing. And I think that as an institution, we are lost. Because one thing that I keep thinking about and can't forget is that our current highest ranking officer in the Department of Defense, Mark Milley, was the former commander of Fort Hood at the height of its criminality, at the height of its sexual assaults and deaths. Right, when there was a mass shooting on that base. But you know, that's the guy that we decided was going to be the best person for that job. So there's a part of me that thinks that there is never an opportunity. Like, can senior officers ever do wrong? And my answer is no. The entire system is set up to protect them because our mandate is difficult, you know, like the military has a very specific job to do, and we haven't reconciled, I think, as a society around the deep failures of how that continues to make everyday soldiers who are largely working people, whether you're an officer or lowly enlisted, right? You're not being paid. I know that we have, there's these jokes about, like, you know, the young E3 who, like, goes and gets, you know, a big car, but, like, these are people are being paid poverty wages to take abuse. And I think a lot about the labor economics of the dynamics in the military.
And also included with that is the lack of, or at least scarce, environmental regulations that allow things like the PFAS contamination of so many bases around the country. And it should be an outrage. It should be something that people are up in arms about greatly. How could our wonderful troops get poisoned while they're trying to protect America? But it's not seen that way. It doesn't, you know, the mythos crushes those kinds of ideas. So I'd like to turn a little bit to the law enforcement perspective on this. And, you know, these are just thoughts and ideas I've had since researching about what happened to Vanessa and the larger systemic issues around military sexual trauma. I want to point a couple things out before I first get into it. First, I'm presuming that both Vanessa's chain of command and the Fort Hood CID or the MPs there believed that she was truly AWOL, not missing or in danger of some kind. Now, I'm not saying that that's an acceptable decision. I flat out refute that notion at all. But if that is the logic, then some of their steps can seem, if not acceptable, a tiny bit more understandable. And following that idea, if she was truly seen as AWOL, that means that this CID and the MPs failed to do a proper initial investigation in and near the sites where she was last seen, including canvassing, you know, doing field interviews, asking everybody what they saw, where they worked that day, all those kind of basic things to give the investigators a picture. That also means that the focus of the investigation never pointed to the subject, Specialist Robinson, until the phone records requested by law enforcement placed him and his girlfriend near the Leon River, where Vanessa's remains were found. And these, like I said, these initial statements, initial interviews, are so paramount to an investigation because they create the parameters for how they're going to move forward, looking through statements for names of people to interview, dates, times, and just while I'm thinking about it, you know, the surveillance conditions on most military bases. I remember working a murder case in 2006 with CID. I was on the drug team, but it was kind of all hands on deck. And one of my jobs was to go to the MP station and sit in front of their computer that managed all of the camera feeds for the post. And I don't know exactly who or what circumstances made it so they said that military posts have poor surveillance or they're not able to pull the tapes or anything like that, but they should. And if they don't, if Fort Hood doesn't, because I was at Fort Lewis for 6 years, and like I said, this kind of stuff was tracked. So moving on to a little more specifics here, why didn't her leaving her personal items behind in the arms room strike a bell with anyone, whether law enforcement or in her chain of command? What did her actual squad leader, section leader, sergeant in charge of her actually do when he found out that she was missing? I'm assuming it's a he, but it could be a female as well. Did any investigator, did any MP actually sit with all these people when she vanished and asked those questions? So you have that the NCO, whoever it was, NCO or officer who called the MPs. You have the armorer, the subject of the investigation, the person who's, we believe, killed her, who told everybody that she left behind her wallet and her room key, which are ordinary human things that we don't leave behind. When you live in the barracks, sometimes the only thing you carry around with you, other than maybe your wallet, is your barracks room key. It's your house. It's where you live. Why in the world would it be randomly left behind if that person went on AWOL? Did any of these NCOs or officers physically go to the arms room where she was last seen to get Vanessa's personal effects or check the arms room to ensure all was well? At this point, and this is a bit morbid, but I think it's very important, it was a crime scene and must have had the strong smell of blood, which is despite all the many odors of a small confined room filled with guns and tools to fix guns, the smell of blood would have been noticeable, if not unavoidable, as would have been the visual evidence of her death. And talking about the arms room for a minute, I want to use that as a little bit of a microcosm to describe how female troops live in the military. In the Army, I assume the Marines and Air Force, everybody else does it pretty similar, arms rooms or armories are usually located in basements or other detached locations. Unless soldiers are drawing weapons for training or maintenance, most of them won't visit these areas as part of the normal jobs. Their seclusion makes them ideal places to harass or corner someone with no one in range to eject or even bear witness to how soldiers who work there are treated, unless leaders regularly go down there and check things out. If Vanessa's supervisors had possibly taken more time to visit her actual workspace instead of simply believing everything was okay, her killer would have been forced to be much more cautious with his treatment of her. So we have this failure to do a basic initial investigation. That's my standing on this right now, is that you go to the arms room. They didn't conduct subject interview of Robinson as the last person who saw Vanessa. There was significant delays in interviewing vital witnesses, which gave Specialist Robinson and his girlfriend the chance to perfect their alibis for when they finally did have questions that they could not easily answer. The phone records that ultimately sent officers to Vanessa's remains near the Leon River were obtained long after they should have been, especially once Specialist Robinson's girlfriend was shown to be lying in her initial interviews. Then, if it wasn't bad enough, once CID found the actual burn site, which had tough box remains, hold on one second. Tough box being a large kind of Rubbermaid container, but they're very tough, and we use them to carry equipment, extra uniforms and stuff on deployments, or it can carry whatever. It's just that they're very common in among soldiers. Once CID actually found the burn site, which had remains from the tough box, they should have treated it as an active crime scene. That means that Vanessa's remains were able to deteriorate and the crime scene unsecured for another 9 days before CID actually found them. And finally, they allow a murder subject to remain only confined to his barracks, but otherwise unsupervised. And I, you know, they may have had a fleet of guys watching him, I don't know, but I would assume it was less than two or less, and he was able to sneak away. I'm of the opinion that they should have apprehended him over what CID chose to do, which to do something called a controlled phone call. And it's essentially where two people involved in a case contact each other, and on one side, the person doing the calling, the investigators are listening. It's an attempt to get a confession. And I feel like that was, they chose to do that over immediately apprehending him, and he fleed and he killed himself. Law enforcement can be super confession hungry, and it goes beyond needing actual proof in a law enforcement investigation. Now, some of this stuff may be cleared up by further investigative work or through FOIA requests, something I'm going to do about this case. The notes that I've compiled here are from an FBI agent's summary of the events through Robinson's death, but the basic timeline makes no sense whatsoever. There are also character questions. Who among Vanessa's unit and COs and officers gave info about Vanessa's character and or was asked about whether her disappearance was something in line with going AWOL? Danny, I know you've experienced this. Troops often do really dumb things, and they also give signs usually when they're going to do that or they're going to go AWOL. Not always, but sometimes. Both Vanessa's boyfriend and her sister spoke to her the day she disappeared. Where are all these people's written statements being asked those questions? Her mom, her sister, her boyfriend, people that she knew. There should be a stack of them. And I believe we've talked a little bit today about credibility. You know, who in the military gets to decide who is and who isn't seen as credible? Who gets to decide that Vanessa's sexual harassment wasn't real or didn't happen because no one in a uniform corroborated it? Why isn't her family statements given the weight of a soldier or an officer? Now, the UCMJ has provisions that give extra weight to a soldier's ostensibly positive service when they're accused of a crime. Their quote-unquote honorable service stands in solidarity with their defense against criminal charges. Why isn't Vanessa's family and the people close to her given that same level of credibility? If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, please visit our website at www.fortressonahill.com. We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, facebook.com/FortressOnAHill, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, and now KBOO.FM. You name it, just about anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? I look around and all I see, masked faces staring at me. Keep your distance, don't touch me. Get your hands off my teepee. Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity? I'm sick and tired of staying at home. Even worse, I live alone. Gotta get out, I need to roam. You can't shake hands on the phone. Touch, I need to feel, I need to hug a friend for real. I'm not down for this new deal. I'm not down for this new deal. The COVID killer keeps piling it on. Counting the dead goes on and on. We gotta stay safe, gotta be strong. Ride this out no matter how long. There's no borders, there's no walls. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Around the world, hear the call. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the
You are
humanity?
Tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.